Welcome to a special election episode of Today in Ohio, normally a news podcast discussion from Cleveland.com and The Plain Dealer. In the election episodes, we're talking to candidates for statewide office. I'm Chris Quinn, here with Seth Richardson, our chief political correspondent, who will conduct the interview. And today we are talking to Tim Ryan, Democratic candidate for the U.S. Senate. Welcome, Tim Ryan.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, Tim, thank you for joining us. Let's go ahead and hop right in. So probably the biggest issue that's at least being talked about or on everybody's mind at the moment is inflation. And I want to know what you think the government should do to curb inflation.
I think we need a tax cut immediately for working people. The earned income tax credit, the child tax credit, a cut in rates with advancing the savings or the reduced rate to get money in people's pockets. I mean, they're just getting hammered right now. It's food, it's gas. You know, we thought we'd be probably winding this thing down. And then the war came and made matters dramatically worse, both from the gas issue and oil issue with Russia to the food issue in the Ukraine. So I think an immediate tax cut. But then there needs to be a longer term strategy on reshoring the supply chains. I mean, that's part of the problem here. It's the chips that go into the cars. It's an over-reliance on China and what they've been doing over the last, you know, three or four decades to where we're not making things here anymore. And that is, after a pandemic, that is very problematic. And so in the short term, a tax cut, in the mid to long term, reshoring and doing everything we can to get some of this high-end manufacturing back here.
Well, that leads directly into my next question, but I'll alter it just a little bit. Is, do you think that Congress should let the Trump tax cuts expire that, you know, were passed? But I'm going to guess that you say probably no, since that mostly affects the lower and middle income earners if they were to expire. What kind of tax cut would you like to see then, if you could give us some numbers, broadly speaking?
Yeah, I would just say, you know, we could sit down and hammer this out. But I think, you know, people, working class people, you know, I mean, couples, you know, making less than, you know, $300,000 a year. I don't know. I mean, we could figure out what the exact number is. But, you know, those are the people that are getting hammered. And so a tax cut for them. And I think it could be a you know, various ones, as I said, the earned income tax credit, the child tax credit, and then a basic reduction in rates with maybe then advancing a check to people just to get some money in their pockets. So that's what I would do. And then asking the wealthiest really to pay more. They're doing very, very well. You see the oil companies' profits are through the roof. You know, the profits for a lot of the corporations are up significantly, while the small business folks are getting hammered because they're more tied to inflation. If you're running a local restaurant, you're buying food and you're trying to travel around, and it's just affecting everybody, Seth. I mean, I could be up in Cleveland with home health care workers, which I was a couple weeks ago, and, you know, and it was, you know, primarily Black women that were getting hammered because they're driving, you know, to work, and that's, you know, been tough. Or I could be along the Ohio River talking to service workers down there, and it's the same thing. So this is something that is across the board hammering people. And I just think Democrats can't be afraid of, you know, saying the phrase tax cut. You know, I mean, like, what's the problem here? And I've been encouraging everybody in the House and the Senate and the White House that'll listen, like, bring it to the floor, let's pass it and help. Start helping people.
Are you looking at this as more of a temporary measure of sorts where there'd be some kind of sunset, or do you want to see a kind of permanent change in the brackets?
Well, I think the conversation for now needs to be, how do we deal with inflation and have enough? Our government needs to be more flexible to address these issues. And so I would say we keep it in the short term and then see where we are, because we do have to be concerned about the long-term issues of deficits and debt. I mean, you can't keep borrowing either. And the deficits is coming down, but we have to make sure that that's something that we're concerned about. But when you're going through emergency circumstances like the pandemic and like now with inflation, I think it'd be appropriate to cut those taxes, ask the wealthiest to pay more to offset it, and maybe even do some deficit reduction. But in the short term, we got to get this done.
What do you think of Biden's proposed, I believe he's calling it the billionaire tax, that tax that would target, I believe, the 700 wealthiest Americans?
Yeah, no, I think it's appropriate. I mean, you know, that's where the money is. And again, I absolutely think we have to ask the wealthiest to pay more. But I don't think it has to be from a place of, you know, we hate you because you're rich, or we hate you because you're a business person. It's got to be like, look, we're all on the same team here. We're all trying to, you know, rebuild the country. We have to figure out how to outcompete China. That means we have to not have huge debts and deficits. It means that we have to have everybody on board. We've got to make investments into infrastructure, bringing shop class back, investing in robustly into our joint vocational schools, making sure our population is healthy, you know, and economically secure. So yeah, we have to do those things, and we have to ask them to pay. But those businesses are on the team too. Like, we have to create jobs. We have to dominate these industries of the future. So I say, yes, we have to, but it doesn't have to be a fight, you know, and maybe it will be a fight. Maybe they'll fight it, but we need them to be a part of the solution here. And that means we have to ask them to pay more.
You touched on it a second ago with, you know, microchips and reshoring, and, you know, you support the CHIPS Act. So I want to add, you know, it's stalled in Congress at the moment. You know, what do you think you can do to, you know, if elected, to help pass that, aside from, you know, obviously voting for it? And also, when you talk about reshoring, what other industries do you see as prime for reshoring in the United States?
Yeah, we're going to get it done. We just voted this week to move the COMPETES Act to a conference committee with the Senate. And it sounds like, you know, in the next couple of weeks, that process is going to move forward. So super excited about that. That is key to the Intel deal that, you know, everybody's talking about. I talked to the CEO. He said, you know, he knew some version of this was going to happen. That's why they made the deal in the first place. And it's $20 billion. 3,000 jobs, be tens of thousands with the spinoff, 7,000 union construction jobs. But once we pass it, he said, this is going to turn very quickly into a $100 billion project, which is going to touch every corner for, you know, our purposes here for this conversation with you guys. 60 of the 100 suppliers to Intel are in Northeast Ohio. So there's going to be a lot of small businesses that are really going to benefit. And that just goes to show you, like, this is, I think, a $50 billion package with the CHIPS Act, the COMPETES Act. I think eventually it's going to be about $250 billion. That just shows you the impact. If we can work with these businesses to reshore, like we're doing with Intel, help their suppliers, I think the CHIPS, then you see the ripple effect. I mean, they're going to bring 30 suppliers to Ohio. I mean, we just saw with the battery plant, in which I think would be another kind of business. I think electric vehicles, to more directly answer your question, electric vehicles, electric trucks, batteries, you know, I think moving into energy, things like hydrogen, natural gas. I think, like, this is all about economic security for our country. You know, liquid natural gas, for example. So I hope that these monies can be used for those other industries. But just to show you, like, the supply chain, I mean, we have this Ultima battery plant, which is an LG Chem and GM partnership in Lordstown. It's, you know, 1,200 union construction jobs, 1,100 permanent jobs that are going to be unionized. And now we're having conversations with suppliers to Ultima that are want to locate in Warren, Ohio. There was just an announcement the other day in Ravenna. They're going to get 100 jobs tied to the battery plant. So what we're starting to see is the supply chain build out. You know, it used to be the auto plant in Lordstown, and then it was the Delphi plant that did the wiring harnesses, and then it was commercial logistics, and then it was the trucks, and it was, you know, it was this whole supply, it was the seat manufacturer. We need to build that out, except this time it's for chips. This time is for electric trucks and electric vehicles. That's exciting. And I think the government has a role in that. And so those are the industries that I would like to see. And in the Senate, I think we have to hit the gas pedal. I mean, Germany does this kind of industrial policy. China certainly has been doing it for a long time. And the United States has been asleep at the switch. So we're just starting to make moves in this direction. And I should note that every Republican in the congressional delegation voted against the COMPETES Act in the House. You know, I mean, it's just this cannot be a political thing. This is a home run for everybody, and we got to get away from the politics.
So moving on a little bit, you know, one of the promises that, you know, Biden and a lot of Democrats made in 2020 was to address student loan debt. Hasn't really been much movement on that. What do you propose to do about mounting student loan debt?
Well, my wife and I understand this. We're still paying off her student loans. And so, you know, and it's I think it's outrageous the rates that people have to pay. 8, 9, 10%, I mean, depending on the loan. So we're working in Congress now and really trying to push through an initiative where you allow borrowers to renegotiate down the interest rate, you know, to, you know, 1 or 2%, which would put a significant amount of money in their pocket, or allow them to pay off the student loan. Also, giving breaks after so many years to people who are working in public service, cops, firefighters, teachers, those kinds of things, I think would be really important. Now, if you take out a loan, you got to pay your loan back. I mean, that's just the way it is. It wouldn't be fair to, you know, all the people who don't go to college, but we should get that rate down. And really, we've got to focus on the other 74% of the people in Ohio who don't have a college degree or aren't going to college. I mean, that's you know, 3/4 of the people. And so what are we doing to increase skills? As I mentioned, shop class, robust investments in the joint vocational schools, apprenticeships, you know, certifications. This is where we have to move, because, you know, you look at like the Intel project. I mean, they're going to need 7,000 construction workers there. You know, and that's just for this facility. The CEO said that they're going to need 5,000 for probably the next 10 years. So we've got to start getting into our high schools. I got some money, an earmark years back called Pathway to the Building Trades. How do we get into the minority community and start getting, you know, kids on a track to be able to get into the unions and to get into construction? You're going to make, they said they're going to make about $100,000 a year building this facility, those union construction workers. So imagine you don't have any college debt. You're a union, you're a union worker, and you're making $100,000 a year, and you're building the future for your kids and for the country. I mean, that's an exciting proposition. So we've got to get with our guidance counselors and really, you know, as I said, shop class. Getting rid of shop class was really a bad idea. Telling everybody they had to go to college was really a stupid idea, because it eviscerated our skilled workforce. So we got to get back to that. And, you know, we can walk and chew gum. We can help with college loan debt and focus on, you know, how we get these people skilled up.
Does that include, you know, in your ideal scenario, does that include any level of forgiveness such as, you know, Biden suggested when he was running for office?
I mean, you could play around the edges. I mean, the principle has to be, if you take out a loan, you have to pay it back. Now, you know, again, you do want to help people that have been basically dealing with usury laws. I mean, 10% for a student loan, I mean, that's insane. And you just can't get out of it. So figuring out a way, maybe for some forgiveness, I think, you know, it would be understandable because of the price that people have paid over the years and haven't made any headway because of the high rate. So, you know, I'd be willing to have that conversation. But the principle is, you took out a loan, you need to pay it, but let's get those rates down so you can really make some headway and put some money in your pocket. And that's going to be nothing but good for the economy, because then you can go out and buy a car, buy a house, or, you know, buy one of these electric vehicles that we'll be making in Ohio. So it all kind of fits together.
So the other, you know, obviously big news that's really been going on for about a month now is the crisis in Ukraine. And there's been a lot of talk about it, mostly from the defense side of things, right? How involved the U.S. should be in supplying weapons or anything like that. But I want to know, do you think that Ohio should accept refugees from Ukraine? And if so, should there be any limits on how many refugees we do accept?
Absolutely, we should. I think, you know, we in Ohio have a very strong Ukrainian community here. And so it would be a natural fit for taking on some of these refugees, and they would have a community with culture and, you know, loving families to be able to, you know, get through this very difficult time. So I think Ohio is, you know, unique in that way, and we should be a part of it. You know, we'd have to look at the numbers as to, you know, how many we would be able to take, and we'd have to talk to some of the experts on that, but we most certainly should be a part of that solution. And I think, you know, it would do nothing but enrich, you know, Cleveland and Youngstown and Toledo and, you know, other areas of the state that have people from Ukraine.
Would you want to see them go through the normal vetting process, or should there be some kind of expedited vetting process considering how much of an active war zone it is over there right now?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you always have to be careful with accepting people, because there are bad actors who would try to get into the country. And so, you know, you have to be compassionate, but you also have to be smart. And so we would have to, you know, make sure that the vetting process was, you know, was legit. But again, you know, we're talking, you know, we watch these people on the news. I mean, clearly these are people running out of the Ukraine. We just need to make sure that we know who everybody is to the extent we can.
So we're coming out of the pandemic. At least it seems that we are coming out of the pandemic, right? Hopefully there aren't any more spikes or anything like that. You really had a front row seat to what was going on as far as the federal government response and even the state government response. And you even, I believe you even had coronavirus at one point. What did you learn from the coronavirus pandemic?
Well, I hope we all learned how to deal with a pandemic. You know,
do you think we did learn how to deal with a pandemic?
Well, I hope. I mean, there's people out there that aren't getting vaccinations. So I would say there's a number of people in our society who don't quite understand the best way to get through it. And so, you know, maybe we could have, maybe we didn't need the level of shutdown, or there would be different ways to handle it. You know, now we have vaccines. I think that was an amazing part of the whole thing of, you know, Operation Warp Speed to get these vaccines done and out the door was really amazing. But again, you know, the key here is like for us not to just fight with each other about every damn thing. You know, it's like, you know, we hate wearing masks. Okay, everybody hates wearing masks. I mean, nobody gets up in the morning and says, boy, I'd love to put a mask on today and have my face sweat and get pimples on my face. You know, I mean, like, we're all doing it for our own health and the health of our kids and our families. How do we deal with it in schools? I mean, we're learning more and more about, you know, what we should do and shouldn't do. So I think now, you know, we should really start looking back and have an honest assessment of, okay, what did we do right? What did we do wrong? We don't need anybody going, oh, I told you you shouldn't have done that. We don't need any of that BS. It's like, let's figure it out. And so that the next time it comes, we understand how to do this with the most minimal amount of damage to the economy, to workers. You know, I mean, you don't need to shame people who aren't going back to work because they have an autoimmune problem. You know, like, oh, they're lazy, they don't want to go to work. Well, if you have an autoimmune problem in the middle of a pandemic and you're a waitress, like, okay, we need to help that person weather this storm. Or if you're a healthy waitress and you're living with your mom and she has issues, you can't go back to work. And so it needs to be a little bit of a culture shift here of showing some decency and respect to each other. I think that's going to be the biggest part. But, you know, help, we didn't do enough to help some of these businesses. We allowed the big businesses to eat up the vast majority of the money from the PPP program, while the small businesses, you know, a lot of them didn't get anything. That was crazy. The issue around distance learning and virtual learning obviously exposed the huge problems that we have with the digital divide, and issues around the broadband that need to be taken care of. So it exposed a lot in our society. And I would just say, lastly, that it really showed how many people are out there busting their rear end and going to work regardless of what's happening, you know, and that it started with, oh, okay, well, we're going to do something for essential workers. And about 3 weeks in, we figured it out that everybody's essential, you know, everybody was needed. So that to me needs to be a shift in the culture too.
Well, you said something interesting in there about not needing to fight with everybody, right? But I think over the past 2 years, we've seen kind of pretty constant fighting, right, in politics. It hasn't exactly been kumbaya really since basically the first month of the pandemic. How confident are you that, you know, we as, you know, a society or, you know, Congress itself or just anything will be able to address any of these issues, considering there is so much bitter division that really was exacerbated by the pandemic?
Yeah, I think the attention that the outliers get is way too much. You know, I mean, we're a big country. We're a country filled with a lot of different kind of people. And, you know, within that, you know, you're going to have some people that are, you know, just do and say weird things. And they, you know, get the right now, the problem is they get a lot of attention. And so saying and doing, you know, showing up at a school board meeting, putting up a camera to face the podium and going in there and just like, you know, basically rolling a metaphorical grenade just to get some attention in the middle of a bunch of community people trying to solve a problem, you know, that kind of stuff, the rhetoric around like the fights and the culture wars and stuff like that can't get the kind of attention that it's been getting if we're going to move forward together. And so we all just need to like say, okay, yeah, there's always been people like that in our society. A little different now with all the social media, but the rest of us need to focus on solving problems and whether it's dealing with the pandemic. I thought it was heartening with the school board races around in November around the state where, you know, 80 to 85% of the people who won the school board races even, you know, were pro public education. We're just their general theme was how do we come together, parents and teachers, in community leaders around solving these problems. And the people who wanted to, you know, just torch the place, you know, they won 15%. So I think most people are there, and it's not a Democrat or Republican thing. It's just like an adult versus like, you know, who immaturity thing.
Well, speaking of Democrat and Republican things, I think we all kind of know there's a reality when it comes to Congress and the Senate and whatnot. So I want to know if you are elected, What could you conceive as a signature piece of legislation that you could realistically get passed through a kind of divided Congress?
I think building on the building on the Competes Act would be something that we just got to do it and then keep doing it. The bipartisan infrastructure bill, great first step. We need to keep doing that. So keeping it on the bread and butter issues. I think, you know, issues around how do we get shop class into all of our schools? How do we, you know, invest into, the joint vocational schools? I think that could very easily be a bipartisan issue. I've worked a long time with David Joyce on the Great Lakes Initiative and the Great Lakes Compact. So, you know, finding issues with Republicans, I'm proud of the last two Congresses. I was in the top 10% of the most bipartisan, people in the House of Representatives. So I think you can only get things done when you're working in a bipartisan way. 'Cause if not, you get something through and then the other political party gets in and they undo it. And then that's bad for stability. So I think it's even more important now to find, you know, what those issues are. I think helping kids with, you know, mental health issues, which is a huge, huge problem. The kids weren't necessarily doing okay before the pandemic, and then to have 2 years of isolation, 2 years of dealing with the pandemic and virtual learning. So I think that should be a bipartisan issue. Reshoring, like 90% of our generic drugs come from China. And I'm working with a very, very conservative Republican on a bill to bring that production back here. Him and I probably don't agree on 95% of things, but we agree on that. So we're working together. So it's really about just finding those areas that you can get a partner on from the opposite political party and actually make some progress here.
Well, who's a Republican in the Senate that you could see yourself working on something with?
Todd Young from Indiana. He was a buddy. I used to work out in the gym with him in the morning for years when he was in the House, and he's been in the Senate now a couple years. I think he would be, somebody that I could very easily work with. And we'll see who else, once I get there. But he would definitely be one that I would work on and work with. I think that would be, the Midwestern folks, I think, where we have a lot of the mutual interests.
So your opponent in this race has pointed out that, you have changed politically over time, right? You sort of trended with the party a little bit, so to speak, right? At the debate the other day, she brought up your former approval from the NRA, right? Mm-hmm. I've, always hear talk about how you used to be more anti-abortion rights and have since, changed your mind on that. I'm kind of curious what, if you could sort of explain some of those decisions and how this sort of political evolution came to be.
Sure. I'd be happy to. So I got to Congress. I was 29 years old. I was, a newbie and, had a lot to learn, but I was raised Catholic. I had 13 years of Catholic school. So my natural kind of position on the issue of choice was to be pro-life. And then, as I got to Congress, I started to listen, I started to, listen to the women who had very difficult circumstances that they were trying to deal with. I listened to my pro-choice colleagues like Rosa DeLauro and others who were also Catholic. And worked with the organizations, Planned Parenthood and Cecile Richards. And we just, built friendships. And I listened and I learned. And I realized that I didn't feel like I was on the right side of the issue. And I just, became more and more convinced that this really was an issue of freedom for women to have to make this decision with their doctor, and that a bunch of politicians in Columbus or Washington, D.C. could not possibly account for the complexities of a pregnancy and all the different scenarios, and that the government just needs to trust women on this. And so that's how that happened. And I hope that, we as a society, would honor somebody's journey of listening and learning, and then, making with based on facts and new understanding, change their position. And that to me is a part of growing and learning and becoming better. And it was the same really with the issue around around gun safety. With Sandy Hook, the school shootings, over time I started to really realize, and then Sandy Hook really kind of was the kind of pivot point where I recognized that the NRA had no interest at all in solving these issues around the gun safety and these school shootings. I mean, they didn't even want to be at the table. And I was mad. I just thought it was appalling. I thought, because I like to go hunting. I hunt with our oldest kid, Mason, who would gladly tell you he's a better shot than I am. But it's like one of the great days that we have, going the night before and maybe watching some football and then getting up in the morning and, going out hunting with, some of our friends. I mean, it's just a great cultural experience. And I felt like the NRA like wasn't even like honoring that because they were like on the other side of the school shootings. And it's like, how could you guys do that? So I took all the money that I got from the NRA and I gave them to groups that would be, you know, helping make communities safe by dealing with the gun issue. And again, it was like my own personal experiences. And I, you know, just say anybody who, you know, started a job when they were 29 and then are now 48, like, did you change any views that you had in your own job and the way you look at the world? I would hope you would, or you're living with your eyes closed and your head buried in the sand. And so, you know, I feel like there's a lot of people that have went through that same evolution. It's just, I did mine, you know, in a very public way.
Hey, Tim, we're going to run out of time, and I wanted to ask you about one element of the campaign. If you were to prevail in the primary and you're heading into November, you're in a state which voted pretty heavily for Donald Trump in the past two elections, and you have a very clear-eyed view on your positions. They're pretty traditional Democratic viewpoints that used to be embraced by a sizable portion of rural Ohio. But that clearly has tilted in recent years in a way that is somewhat confounding, because the Republicans under Trump really didn't help people in rural Ohio. How do you deal with that if you're going into November? How do you deal with showing the people in rural Ohio who have pretty much switched to the Trumpy side of the map that is not in their best interest, and that switching to you is a better way to build for their future?
Really telling them who I am, you know, where I come from. I've been amazed just in the last year, almost a year since we've been traveling the state. We've hit almost 80 of the 88 counties. When people hear that I'm from the Youngstown area, there's immediate rapport, because they know that I know what they've been through. You know what I mean? Like they know that my life experiences of job loss and bad trade deals and, you know, jobs going to China, like that's my family. Like my family worked in those factories and lost their jobs. So I understand it. And so I think just meeting them and letting them know that I know what's happened, and really that I've taken on my party. I mean, I took Obama on TPP, much like Sherrod Brown did. We're fighting for Buy American provisions, which we got into the infrastructure bill because we know how important that is for American manufacturing. I ran against Nancy Pelosi for Democratic leader. I get in fights with Bernie Sanders. Like I get in fights with Republicans too. So like, I just want them to know that I'm for them, because no party has gotten it right on some of these major issues. And we can't make decisions based on, oh, you're this party or that party. You got to make your decisions on, you know, where do you stand on these issues? And do you have the guts to take your own party on? And I passed that test with flying colors. And we have a lot of Republicans that are coming out for us, that are coming to our events, that want to publicly support us. I can't tell you how many two-time Trump voting veterans we have in our vets groups that are supporting me. So, you know, we're paying them respect by going to their communities, and they know I know what they've been through, and they know I'm going to fight like hell for them. And really, that's how we're going to win this race.
Well, once we get past the primary, you can bet that this is very likely going to be a circus campaign based on who your opponent, if you prevail, is likely to be. Thanks very much for doing this. We really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to a special episode of Today in Ohio, a special campaign episode. Come back and listen to our regular weekday episodes when we discuss the news. Thanks for listening.